for brown fat. Unlike white fat cells that store energy, brown fat burns energy. It's typically found in hibernating animals and human babies. When it's cold, brown fat burns calories, which releases heat to keep the body warm. Until recently, scientists thought that as people grew, their brown fat melted away. But it turns out that human adults have some brown fat too. This discovery is pretty new, so scientists are still figuring out what it means and whether brown fat can somehow be used to help people lose weight. But there are some promising signs. Studies have shown that lean people tend to have more brown fat, and that the fat is most active in cool temperatures. So it's possible that people become obese partly because they don't have enough brown fat to burn excess calories. Scientists are now working on ways to help obese bodies create more brown fat. Experimenting with proteins, Harvard researchers have managed to ramp up production of brown fat cells in mice. Brown fat is no miracle cure for obesity. It's not clear whether having more brown fat actually does or could lead to more weight loss. And scientists are a long way from being able to increase brown fat stores in people. But at the very least, we've learned that not all fat is necessarily bad. Down the road, brown fat may help make people's lives better. This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Office of the Provost. Today's program was prepared by Jeremy Shear with help from David Dalicki in the Medical Sciences Program. I'm Yael Cassander.
In sports, the scene is set for the start of the World Series. Game 1 will take place Wednesday night in New York as the Yankees entertain defending world champion Philadelphia. The pitching matchup has two Cy Young Award-winning left-handers, CeCe Sabathia for the Yankees against Cliff Lee of Philadelphia. Tony La Russa will return for a 15th season as manager of the St. Louis Cardinals. The other big news announced today is that Mark McGwire will join La Russa's staff as hitting coach. Among games in the NHL tonight, the Chicago Blackhawks host the Miami Wild. And in football news from yesterday, the Indianapolis Colts have routed the Rams 42-6 in St. Louis. Peyton Manning threw for 3 touchdowns but didn't get a chance for a 6th straight 300-yard passing game. He was 23 for 34 for 235 yards. The Colts defense got its first score of the year on rookie Jacob Lacy's 35-yard interception return. And it might have been one of the worst days in Chicago Bears history. Former Bear Cedric Benson ran for 189 yards and a touchdown yesterday to help Cincinnati win 45-10 at home against Chicago. Bears quarterback Jay Cutler threw 3 interceptions and fumbled 2 snaps. That's sports. It's 2:43. This story begins in 2005 when a Danish newspaper published cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. The cartoons led to riots around the world. Some 200 people were killed. Yale University Press has just published a book about the controversy called The Cartoons That Shook the World. As Diane Orson of member station WNPR reports, the book has sparked a controversy of its own.
No place for hate. About a dozen Yale University students are protesting a visit by Danish cartoonist Kurt Westergaard, who drew the now iconic image of the Prophet Muhammad wearing a lit bomb in his turban with the Creed of Islam written in Arabic on the wrappings.
For some people, I am a kind of provocation. I go for the dialogue, but it is not very easy. I have tried to speak with many Muslims, and often the conversation has ended up in a curse, you know, go to hell and burn up. And I have asked, perhaps we could talk in hell.
There were many different reasons why Muslims were upset.
Jutta Clausen is a politics professor at Brandeis University. She was in the Middle East at the time of the cartoon controversy, interviewing Muslim leaders for another project. She signed a deal with Yale University Press to write an academic book unraveling the events that led to the violence. In doing her research, Clausen found out that imams and activists in Denmark exploited the cartoons to incite Muslims around the world. She also learned that the demonstrations which followed were sponsored in part by radical Islamists and in part by governments.
The Egyptian government and the Turkish government were extremely instrumental in pushing forward the conflict. They primarily wanted to put on record with the United Nations that Europeans and Westerners discriminate against Muslims and are Islamophobic.
Clausen, who's Danish, spent 3 years researching the book. The manuscript went through the usual academic peer review process. Then, just a few weeks before publication, Yale University, which owns the Yale Press, mounted a second review. The university asked some 20 scholars, counterterrorism officials, and national security experts to assess the risk of more violence if copies of the cartoons were included in the book.
And it was fairly overwhelming.
Yale Press director John Donatich.
The people who knew the most about this kind of situation said, don't do it, that this is likely to provoke violence.
One of the experts was former director of national intelligence John Negroponte.
I felt that there was a considerable risk that more violence, possibly even resulting in serious injury or death, could occur as a result of the publication of these images.
The university told the press to eliminate the cartoons from the book, along with all other images of the Prophet Muhammad. Clausen was told she'd have to sign a non-disclosure agreement if she wanted to read the experts' comments. She declined to do so. But she says she was even more dismayed to learn that the panel had not read her book.
My first reaction was that it was stunningly similar to what happened during the conflict itself, and I disagreed with the experts' advice. I felt had the experts read my book, they would not have given the advice they produced.
Still, Clausen decided to publish with Yale Press. Tariq Masood of Harvard's Kennedy School of Government says both sides were grappling with sensitivity to Muslims and Islamic culture. On one hand, Yale didn't want to offend Muslims by reprinting the images.
But I would also argue that Professor Clausen is coming from a similar place as well, that you can publish the cartoons without inciting violence, that Muslims are not really these excitable people who are irrationally given over to violence and anger.
Back on campus, Yale student Fatima Ghani says she's glad the press took the cartoons out of the book. She says they're not an expression of free speech, but hate speech.
People don't see this the same way they would see a swastika or they would see the N-word. They see bigotry against Muslims in a separate category as they see bigotry against other races or religions.
But critics, from the American Association of University Professors to the Penn American Center, have opposed Yale's decision to publish a scholarly book without including the images of the very subject the book covers. Some people charge that the university is concerned with its image in the Middle East. Clausen says Yale overreacted.
I cannot recall any similar instance where anticipatory fear of adverse consequences to Yale University private interest or perhaps more general public interest have ever influenced how a book is presented and how a scholarly debate can proceed.
Clausen says she hopes that a later edition of the book may include the cartoons. In the meantime, she's begun thinking about another project, a look at the impact of national security on the world of academic publishing. For NPR News, I'm Diane Orson in New Haven.
Coming up this afternoon on The World from PRI, Ukraine's dueling languages. Ukrainian was the language of peasants in Soviet times. Now it's as popular as Russian and championed by Ukraine's politicians and pop musicians. That story in the day's news coming up at 3 on The World. Music video games are among the world's most popular, earning billions of dollars, selling to gamers who delight in shredding through a song by Jimi Hendrix or Aerosmith. NPR's Neda Ulaby says the company that makes Guitar Hero is tweaking that franchise with a new game that comes out tomorrow.
The game is called DJ Hero, and it's about as true to actual DJing as Guitar Hero is to actual rock stardom. Jamie Jackson is creative director of Freestyle Games, that developed both DJ and Guitar Hero.
It's not about you being a DJ and simulating. That wasn't the idea. It's about having fun and feeling like you're controlling the party. So all the music is pre-made by our DJs.
Meaning it's a pre-mixed, pre-sampled, pre-beat-matched assortment of popular tunes. Freestyle developers worked with about 20 DJs to figure out how to turn turntabling into something playable on an Xbox. It works like Guitar Hero, but instead of that plastic guitar, you get a fake turntable and a fake little mixer, while a funky DJ avatar struts, cuts, and scratches on screen.
He is enjoying himself.
Robert Carter is a DJ who plays nationally under the name DJ Cousin B. By day, you'll find him including audio for NPR's website. I asked him to play DJ Hero.
Takes some getting used to, but then again, this is a game.
Freestyle Games recruited a few illustrious DJs to add cred.
It's your boy, DJ Grandmaster Flash. I'm going to be a professor.
Okay, you got Flash on here, okay. So it's official.
Now let's talk about tapping.
I never had Flash teach me how to DJ, so let's do it.
We decided to pit DJ Cousin B against a gamer, NPR intern Brian Reardon.
You're overthinking it. You just got to move it. Just moving it back and forth.
Oh, yeah, I'm overthinking it. I'm at an NPR, not the club.
DJ Cousin B was experiencing the same problems some guitar players have with Guitar Hero. Real skills don't translate. They confuse you.
That's weird. Because you normally don't scratch with just one finger, so it's really strange, but okay.
When Freestyle Games first developed DJ Hero, creative director Jamie Jackson asked regular people what they thought DJs did.
99% of them put one hand to their ear and the other made a scratching sound and kind of went, wicka, wicka, wicka.
See, I mean, I don't know anything about turntables, and I'm sure, like I have no idea what this... I've never known what guys are doing when they do that.
Gamer Brian Reardon still utterly destroys the DJ in this virtual battle. Robert Carter is a fabulous DJ in real life. He's not fabulous at scoring points in the game's glamorous industrial nightclub.
You are just stinking up the joint.
They just booed me.
Oh, you didn't even get one star.
I didn't get a star, man. They booed me.
Is there anything about this that's like actual DJing?
DJs fantasize for an environment like this. You have about 30,000 people out there going crazy. I mean, it's everybody's reacting. No fights out there.
DJ Cousin B, a.k.a. Robert Carter, says this game is perfect if you want to one-up a DJ.
Say, man, like, you know, I think you would be nice at DJ Hero. Let me check you out. And you just kill him.
Still, Carter plans to get the game for his little 8-year-old nephew. In a few years, he says, he'll teach him how to DJ for real. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
It's 2:53. There's a man-made canal that connects the Mississippi River system with the Great Lakes. The Chicago Ship and Sanitary Canal makes shipping cargo between the waterways possible. It also makes it possible for invasive pests in the water to invade both systems. The big concern right now is a big, nasty group of fish known as Asian carp. The fish have already invaded the Mississippi and some of its tributaries. An electric barrier has been built in the canal to try to stop the fish from getting into the Great Lakes. Lester Graham talked with Jennifer Nalbone about the problem. She's the director of navigation and invasive species with the environmental group Great Lakes United.
They are just incredible eaters, and they get as big as 3 to 4 feet, 80 to 100 pounds when mature, and they're just prolific. Some species, the females can produce over 1 million eggs in their lifetime. So the fear is that, like they've done in the Mississippi River Basin, they'll get so big, they'll have no predators, they'll eat so much food, and there'll be so many that they'll basically take over the ecosystem. In some areas where they've invaded, upwards of 90% of the river's biomass is carp.
You've probably seen this fish on videos or something like that. They're the ones that, as a boat passes by, they'll jump out of the river and sometimes even hit the boaters.
I admit, the first time I saw a video of the jumping silver carp, I was so startled I laughed at it. But there's nothing funny about 50, 60, 70 pounds of fish flying at you when you're going 20 miles an hour. It could kill someone.
Now, there's this electric barrier in place. It actually shocks the water, so the fish is discouraged from coming to the area. But now there's concern that the fish has invaded a nearby river, the Des Plaines River. It's very close to this canal. So why is that a problem?
Our concern is with flooding. Just last year, we saw major floodwaters in the Des Plaines River, where floodwaters connected the Des Plaines and the Chicago Sanitary Ship Canal in streams of water several feet deep, and carp could be carried into the Chicago Sanitary Ship Canal in those floodwaters.
So what are you proposing? How can we stop the fish from going any further?
Well, the long-term solution is hydrologic separation of the Mississippi River Basin and the Great Lakes Basin. Army Corps of Engineers has been authorized to study that problem, but that's a multi-year project. Right now, what we're concerned about are floodwaters this fall. We are pressing that the Army Corps of Engineers put in place sandbags or berms in the low points between the Des Plaines and the canal, and also fill in some of the culverts in the IMN Canal that connect to the Chicago Sanitary Ship Canal.
Now, I've watched this situation for years, long before the Asian carp invaded the Mississippi River system, and I'm wondering, even if further millions of dollars are spent to try to put up barricades or stop this fish, whether it's simply inevitable that this fish will get into the Great Lakes.
Well, this is a battle against time right now. If we can block the future floodwaters from the Des Plaines, which is probably our biggest hole in our defense right now, and plug the culverts in the IMN, we can buy ourselves some good time, but we won't be out of the woods until we separate the Mississippi and the Great Lakes Basin. But we can't let this invasion happen. It would be perhaps the greatest anticipated ecological tragedy of our time. So I don't think that inevitable is an option. We have to get it done.
Jennifer Nalbone is with the group Great Lakes United. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you, Lester.
Lester Graham is with the Environment Report.
Earth and Sky.
Saving Earth's tropical forests will help avoid the worst effects of climate change. That's according to environmentalist and Nobel Peace Laureate Wangari Maathai. She founded the Green Belt Movement, which has planted over 40 million trees across Africa. We spoke by phone.
Scientists tell us that 20% of the greenhouse gases, especially carbon, is coming from deforestation and degradation of forests, and especially of the huge tropical forests in the Amazonia, in the Congo, and Southeast Asia. Three blocks of forest that are often referred to as the three lungs of the planet. They control, they regulate the climate of the world.
Maathai said that reducing emissions from deforestation hasn't received enough attention by the world's leaders.
Even the carbon dioxide that we are exhaling ourselves, let alone that which is coming from our transport industries, the cars, the planes, and all the other activities that we do, burning charcoal and all the other fossil fuels. So, folks, trees are the best friends you have on the planet. They need to be planted, and those that are standing need to be protected and appreciated.
More science interviews at our website. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programs are made possible by English Hedgerow, offering gourmet foods and distinct